You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Yeah, solidarity forever. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt. G'day, Matt, how are you?
Pretty good, Annie, pretty good, Annie. Because there was a pretty, there was a really good outcome this week in Tuesday in the city of Darebin. There was the council meeting on Tuesday night, and one of the motions put forward was for the Darebin Council to actually go through the process and actually rename the Reservoir Library after the long-serving councillor Gaetano Greco. There were quite a number of community members that were in the gallery that night, and there were five community members who made very compelling and heartfelt and very thoughtful submissions, including our long-serving friend and member of this show, Tabea. He gave a very somewhat humorous start to his speech when he said, "I'd would like to acknowledge the mayor and councillors for giving me the opportunity to procrastinate for, again against my university assignments." But it was a very good outcome because there was some concern about members in the community that perhaps the motion wouldn't succeed. But I think because of the sheer numbers of community members coming out that night and the submissions, that it was approved. So the next steps are that Darebin Council needs to go through a formal community consultation process, as well as statute requirements to do with place names. That's with Geographic Names Victoria, which is the statutory body, and then they can make the application, I understand, April next year, after, and then go through the community consultation process. But this is a really great outcome, and I think it illustrates, again, a great example of what can happen when like-minded individuals with goodwill come together.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. It's great to hear such a positive story, especially on a local level.
Yeah, it was really great. And again, it was an outcome that I understand the family wanted, because the council did approach the family members, and that's what they wanted as the memorial. They wanted the Reservoir Library to be named after Gaetano.
Yeah, fantastic. What a great man, and what a great individual, and a great community member. It's going to be great. The library is a perfect remembrance space for such a great person who was all about growing and positivity.
And he mentored and encouraged a lot of people in the community, including some of the people who are in the council at the moment. But not only just in terms of becoming a councillor, but also he would encourage people, for example, if he knew someone would be have particular abilities or perhaps had abilities that could be developed, he would encourage them perhaps to get involved with a community group or with a consultative committee. And that's what he was all about, really. Inclusivity, trying to develop people, it needed a bit of encouragement. And he was a great man, a really great man.
He was. If we're going to start local, we'll go to state news. You may be aware that Victorian government is showing its colours. Not only did it get the police to raid, in inverted commas, the CFMEU offices this week past for and have the mainstream media talk about five arrests, when in actual fact there was absolutely no purpose in the activity except for political point scoring. People could easily have been given, if they wanted, their phones, if they wanted it. I mean, the place is under administration, and the idea that you can do political point scoring of this nature is an embarrassment. Accounts of one of the people who this happened to, the police arrived, you know, 12 to 15 police turned up at 6:30 in the morning, and they made him, they handcuffed him so that they could have a public display, even though there was absolutely no reason to do so. And they towed away his car, even though there was absolutely nothing there. So really it was a piece of theatre. So you should be very careful about what you think about this particular Labor government and this new Premier. And on the same theme, anti-union bill passed that they've got going, where they want to attack RAFU, one of the few fighting unions, and there is a correlation between attacks on the CFMEU and RAFU, because both of them are fighting unions. The Community and Public Sector Union, CPSU, opposes the Association's Incorporation Reform Amendment Bill, that's what it's called, 2026, Association's Incorporation Reform Amendment Bill 2025, after it was passed through the lower house last night. The bill, which trying to solve the problem of red unions operating in the state, will also remove genuine union representation for thousands of workers. The CPSU knows that red unions are a genuine problem. They appear to be union-like while promoting a model of individual representation that is at odds with collective trade unionism. However, we only need to look at the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union, RAFU, as an example of a union that was established by workers to genuinely represent the rights of workers. RAFU was born from the frustrations and challenges faced by hospitality workers who felt unrepresented by their default union, the SDA. This bill would remove the freedom that workers currently have to join unions, build unions, and participate in them. Rather than further restricting workers' capacity to organise, government should be expanding it through strengthening freedom of association, removing unnecessary restrictions on industrial action, supporting collective bargaining, and giving workers a meaningful right to strike. Giselle Hanna, a CPSU Victorian secretary, is quoted as saying, "The answer to bad unionism is better unionism. Established unions should not need governments to protect us from dissatisfied workers. Our job is to give workers a reason to join us, participate in us, and stay with us. We cannot solve problems by legislating away the competition. We solve them by organising, by becoming more democratic, and by building the industrial power necessary to actually win things for workers. There is another step Ben Carroll can take if he is serious about defeating red unions: call on the federal government to legislate to a genuine right to strike." There's going to be a rally in support of RAFU on the 5th, Saturday the 5th of September. It's at 1 o'clock. It's going to be outside the Victorian Labor offices, and talk about a sign of the times when it comes to Labor politics. The Labor's offices are at 438 Docklands Drive, Docklands, so out of the way. I've been there for refugee rallies too. It's important to stand behind RAFU. RAFU has recently just had a major victory in the courts for low-paid workers at places like McDonald's and Domino's. And it's very suspicious that the SDA, that is the default union for very conservative, very right-wing Catholic, dare I say, because they are one of the standout unions that have publicly stood against equal marriage rights for gay people, as well as a whole range of other very conservative elements. They push, they've got a very strong representation within the Labor Party and machinations, and Ben Carroll is now showing his true colours. And let me add that the same is this, can be said for the South Australian Premier Melanakis.
In fact, wasn't I recall Ben Carroll's first press conference, and he was out the front of Kmart Airport West, and I thought to myself, of his links with the STA.
Well, it's sort of a horrible sort of sensation of the groper unions that led to the attacks on the Communist Party in the past, and is also part of the, if you go back to the Labor Party history of the split in Victoria in the early 50s.
It was 55,
Annie? Yeah, around that time, 53, yeah. And it's like a backlash. The backlash is the right-wing Catholic backlash is coming for us all. Let's change tack and go to New South Wales with this hideous announcement that IDF, past and present, are going to run in the Sydney Marathon.
We found out, and we were, Annie and I were talking off air just before, and we both found this out, I think it was late on Thursday, that apparently the Sydney Marathon is taking place tomorrow. There's something like 39 or 40 currently serving soldiers with the Israeli occupation forces who have been allowed to enter the country and compete in the Sydney Marathon.
Under this badge?
Under this badge. And the way that it's been labelled by, we'll refer to them as Zionist organisations, as it is a peace type of campaign.
Not propaganda,
but as like as a peace
campaign.
And not
rubbing our noses in it.
Yeah, well, that's outrageous enough. But we'll just also, I guess, introduce another story. I'm sure listeners are probably aware of Egyptian satirist and comic Bassem Youssef, and he's been in Australia before. He was supposed to come to Australia for a series of performances. He's now been told that he needs to provide evidence of his criminal history going back to the time that he was in Egypt. So this is going back more than a decade ago. Just give you a bit of context for Bassem's background. My understanding is around about just prior to the events of the Arab Spring, he was running a successful satirical program on Egyptian TV, and that program was very critical of the Egyptian political leadership, and he had to leave the country. And now he's been, because of that pressure he put on with his satirical news program, and he's been in America since then. It's just interesting that someone who's come to Australia before, there's been no issues. And I must add, I've seen him interviewed online, and he actually has Palestinian family. His wife is Palestinian. So that's an interesting juxtaposition that somehow people who've directly involved in the events that are taking place in Gaza and probably in Lebanon. Actually, I understand, now I recall, the members who were from the occupation forces are actually from the infamous Al-Ghilani Brigade. The Al-Ghilani Brigade. They're allowed to enter into Australia, whereas a satirist and a comic is not allowed to enter into Australia until he provides further evidence of his suitability to enter into the country.
It's disgraceful.
It's disgraceful. It's absolutely disgraceful.
And the cherry on the top, the Sydney film.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. Annie and I were talking about this as well. Part of the unfolding, saga with the Royal Commission, I think it was Tuesday I read that the current chair of the Sydney Film Festival, Mr. Peter Avany, is part of their advisory council. He told the Royal Commission that government funding in the arts should only go towards work that didn't undermine, and, the phrase of the moment, social cohesion.
Which is a ludicrous statement.
And then it gets better, and I say that ironically, and that candidates for senior appointments should have their previous public comment, conduct or commentary vetted, including social media statements.
Oh, my God, it's just unreal.
When I read that, my mind earlier this week, my mind immediately went to David Stratton, and because he was at one time, in the early days of Sydney Film Festival, he was part of that board, and I recall that when he was alive, I actually saw an interview with him in person. He was vociferous against censorship, and in his interviews, and I know in his books and memoirs, he recalled a number of clashes that he had with the then censorship board. So I just want to point that out as an interesting juxtaposition. I just wonder what he would make of all this.
There's so many things to talk about this week, but there's anniversaries. Tampa. If you follow up some of the breakfast shows next week, they're going to follow up the Tampa. It's 25 years since that particular event happened. But also, of course, on the 23rd of August was the anniversary, the 60th year anniversary of the Wave Hill walk-off. And I went down to the five-hour stop work at Melbourne University on Thursday, which was put on against overwork, but also outside the John Medley building, because the powers that be at Melbourne University want to knock it down. That they've got they're crying poor, but they've got $8 billion in their war chest of buildings. They've been reported to say that buildings are more important because they're going to be there much longer than any of the students or any of the teachers. And there seems to be this mismatch between the governance bodies at the university and the reality of what a university is. They obviously think it's like the hydrogen bomb. You can drop the hydrogen bomb, the buildings will still be there, but the people will be killed. But the first speaker was Kim Alley, and I'll let her introduce herself, but she does this fabulous speech that actually rounds up all the issues around the walk-off and the anniversary. So I thought I'd share it for you to listen.
Great to see so many people here. Hi, everybody. My name is Kim Alley. I'm a senior lecturer here in the School of Social and Political Sciences. I am also a Murray woman from North Queensland. My grandfather is from Gujal country out west, back Queensland, and my grandmother is from Kamilaroi country down on the New South Wales, Queensland border. So I do want to acknowledge that we are once again meeting on traditional Aboriginal land. We're meeting on the land of the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. This land has never been ceded. It has always been and always will be Aboriginal land. And I want to pay my respects to elders past and present, and to acknowledge all of our Indigenous staff that are joining us here today. And I'm just going to, in the couple of minutes that I've got here, I did just want to talk about the importance of trade unions to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander struggle. It has been intricately linked from the very beginning of the modern Aboriginal rights movement, back in the 1920s when Fred Maynard and Tom Lancey formed the Aboriginal Progressive Association. They were workmen working on the docks in Sydney, and they met seamen from across from the US and who are involved in the international workers' movements, and they decided to join together and to actually campaign for Indigenous rights and against the hated protection board of the day that was controlling every single aspect of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander life. We, some of the key leaders, as I'm sure you know their names, Bill Ferguson, William Cooper, were also trade unionists and were very active. And of course, William Cooper and Bill Ferguson were instrumental in organising the Day of Mourning in 1938, which is the predecessor of what we now know as Invasion Day here on the 26th of January every year. In 1946, we had the Pilbara strike, which was the longest industrial, still today, longest industrial strike in Australia. And this was led by Julie Binbin and Clancy McKenna and Daisy Bindi, who were active in the union. They led more than 800 Aboriginal workers, pastoral workers, off into strikes. The strike lasted more than 3 years. They were demanding not only better wages and better working conditions, but also, again, freedom of movement from and freedom from the hated protection acts which Aboriginal people were forced to live under at that time, which controlled every single aspect of our lives. We also then, you know, we look at 1966, this year, just the other day, we had the anniversary of the Gurindji strike that took place. But before the Gurindji strike, there was an earlier strike 3 months earlier at Newcastle Downs, also in Northern Territory, which was led by Dexter Daniels. And they, at the time, the Arbitration Commission said, yes, Aboriginal workers should get the same wage as white workers, but they also said, we're not going to institute this for 2 years because we want to give the pastoralists a chance, basically, to effectively hire white workers over the Aboriginal stockmen and workers on the pastoral leases. So, of course, the workers in Newcastle Downs went out on strike. And then three months later, we also saw Vincent Lingari, who was the head stockman, led people off into Wadi Creek. And we saw this turn into a 10-year struggle, also not only for obviously the rights of Aboriginal workers, but also for our land rights. And it was the very first time that we saw any land given back to Aboriginal communities. They didn't get all of their land back, but they did get some of it in 1975 when Gough Whitlam famously poured the sands, the red soil through Lingari's hands. So it's really important for me as not only an Aboriginal woman, but also as somebody who's been long involved in activism, but also to be part of my union. And I think it's so great that everybody's here. And if you are here and supporting the strike but not part of the union, please do join. It's really, really important that you do. Because it's only through our collective power that we can win anything. It's always historically been that way, whether it be for Aboriginal rights, whether it be for women's rights, whether it be against any sorts of racism. It's really, really, really important that we do that. And I'm not going to talk too much about some of our dance demands that we're doing, but I did want to mention one particular one. And while it's not at the top of the list, it is important. It's the one for academic freedom. And we have had lots of attacks over the last couple of years, as we all know, including on this campus, on our rights to academic freedom, whether we're students or academics. And it is really, really important that this is part of our legislation of demands that we're putting forward, because that attack is still ongoing. We've seen it in the media, we've seen it across the country, and we need to stand up and defend our right to academic freedom, and it's very important. Workers of the world, unite! One struggle!
G'day, this is Birrigan from Woolagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi Country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
And you're with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to go to Voices for Palestine. We've got a recording from a Sydney event that happened on Wednesday, August the 26th, outside the Sheridan Grand, Sydney. Opposite Hyde Park in Elizabeth Street, Sydney CBD. It's recorded by Vivian Langford. They from the Climate Action Show, which is on at 5 on Mondays on 3CR and podcast, of course. This is about a Stop the War on Palestine protest. It's against Australia's explosives exports to Israel at Sydney's logistics conference. And they're outside on the opening night of this logistics conference that gave room for the Albanese government sitting down with Thales and CMA, CGM, who are actually deeply involved.
And I understand that Thalys got offices here, Annie, as well.
Oh, yeah. I know. The level of complicity with the Israeli US attacks around the world and this lawlessness and Australia's connection is deeply disturbing. And I'll have to say that the Albanese government's become a mighty contender for the an award for two-facedness, the Janus Award, because they say one thing and then do another, and they've made it into they've probably got some book with how do you do it, because every time they say something, I just wait for them to backpedal. It's become embarrassingly obvious. Anyway, the little bit that we've got is Irma Dull from she's from the MUA, and she was part of she gave a speech at this rally.
Now, port members from around the world have been staunch in standing up against the dirty racket that is global weapon shipping to Israel, with powerful shipping strikes and blockades. In 2024, New South Wales Maritime Union officials were arrested at Port Botany in protest to blockade an Israel dim ship. And in February this year, workers at over 20 Mediterranean ports went on strike to block vessels like the Zim Virginia, suspected of arms shipments to Israeli ports. So it gives me great pleasure to announce our last speaker for the evening, rank and file member of the Maritime Union of Australia, Irma Dull.
Thanks everyone for coming out, and I'd also like to acknowledge that we're meeting on the land of the Gadigal people tonight. I'm here with a few of us from the Maritime Union, Wharfies, Seafarers. As Gabriel said, you know, we have consistently taken a position as a union and within our union for a free Palestine against this genocide. And we, you know, amongst us, me and Ryan, you know, we've been over to Palestine as union representatives, where we met with truck drivers who had to wait at the border for 6 to 8 hours, sometimes longer, just doing their normal day's work because, you know, of the border closures and the restrictions of movement. These are the kind of basic, you know, indignities that ordinary workers in Palestine face on a normal day, let alone, you know, the teachers, the nurses, the doctors, the journalists who have been targeted and slaughtered in this disgusting genocide on Gaza. Amongst our members as well, we've had MUA members who've been arrested under Chris Minns's anti-protest laws, blockading Zim ships, saying that, you know, we don't want to do trade with apartheid. You know, we marched under the slogan, if they block aid, we block trade. And they continue to block aid. And the people in this conference behind us today are talking about things like global risk outlook and, you know, global trade outlook. Well, the global trade outlook for Palestine and Gaza is that they don't have a port. They've never been allowed to have a seaport or an airport as part of being denied a state. And all of the imports are controlled by, you know, Israel and the neighboring states, Egypt and Jordan and so on, that keep those borders closed. And they aren't able to access basic, you know, foods and medicines, which is what we as maritime workers working, you know, on and around these vessels, that's what we want to be doing when we go to work. We want to be loading, you know, food and nappies and toys and play equipment and medicines, not this, you know, horrific explosives that we've found out about that CMA, CGM, is transporting, you know, to the US. And actually, just recently, I was at work here in Port Botany, and six artillery vehicles, rocket launchers, were left on our port. You know, they've come off a ship. We're a commercial port. We're not a military. You know, we don't take military cargo. And this is absolutely, like, looking into it a little bit, this is part of the Albanese government's expansion of the military here, their greater entwinement with the US. And it's, you know, it's concerning to all of us. Some of the companies that are inside today as well, you know, we've got Maersk. There was a whole campaign called Mask Off Maersk, led by the Palestinian youth movement and dockers in Europe for their role in transporting weapons around the world and their, you know, integral role in the logistics of weapons transfer. They've got Amazon speaking, one of the most notoriously anti-union companies in the world. And most of Friday, what they're going to be talking about in there is AI and how to replace us and, you know, get rid of workers. They don't care about us. They don't care about the people who work on their ships or on their ports, let alone the consequences of the trade that they're doing that's contributing to this genocide in Gaza. So the only people that care are people like us here out at these rallies and the people who work in those industries. You know, we have those connections with, you know, the crew who work on those vessels. We work in an industry that is international. These people know it's international. That's why they've got, you know, government ministers from New Zealand, from Australia, from the USA. They have a Marine commissioner speaking in there today, along with all these corporate criminals. They're organizing internationally, and we have to organize internationally as well. And that's why we're for internationalizing the resistance, globalizing the resistance, and globalizing the Intifada. Australia is a signatory to the 1949 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide and has an obligation to prevent genocide and not be complicit in genocide. And workers knowingly or unknowingly should not be put in a position where we are forced to breach those conventions. 100%. And that is why we stand here today, because we do not want to participate in that trade, but we face very draconian, you know, anti-protest and anti-strike laws, which this Labor government has not only left in place, but they've, you know, strengthen these anti-protest laws. They impose these anti-strike laws and massive fines on us, and they've attacked unions like the CFMEU that have defied those anti-strike laws to make the rest of us, you know, even more fearful. But workers across Europe have been repeatedly taking action, and there's another general strike day coming up on October 30 where 40 ports all across the Europe and Mediterranean are taking action, saying that ports must not be used for the transport of arms and ammunition, military equipment, or troops destined for war zones. And they're also taking aim at their own governments that are putting massive amounts of spending into the military, just like ours, when that money should be going into NDIS, into education, into our healthcare system, into properly funding our services and so on. And our union has committed to support, to exploring and acting upon any exports to Israel if they find any cargo that's being used to perpetrate the genocide against the Palestinian people. But the bigger that we make this movement on the outside, the easier it is for us, you know, in those workplaces to have those conversations, build support, educate people, because so many people don't realise just how complicit the Australian government is. This isn't something just happening on the other side of the world. It's happening right here. You know, every workplace, every city, there is 100 ties that need to be broken. You know, the nurses are doing a fantastic job standing up to the APRA, which adopted the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and is trying to, you know, make healthcare workers across the country terrified to speak, you know, to be critical of Israel and the genocide. So every union, every workplace, every community group, campus has a role to play. I'll just end with a new chant. See if you can remember this one. So the shipping company is called CMA CGM. CMA CGM, put those weapons in the bin. CMA CGM, put those weapons in the bin. CMA CGM, we will fight and we will win. CMA CGM, we will fight and we will win. Thank you very much.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters. On behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
And you're back with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast. And we've got John Kelly on the line. He's a conservation advocate and he's from the Invasive Species Organisation. G'day, John. How are you?
Good, thanks, Annie. How are you doing?
Good. Now, I'm not sure people are very aware of just how invasive the species are in Australia. If you go to the bush, you're really aware of it. But do you want to give our listeners some understanding of what the Invasive Species Organisation is focusing on?
Yeah, so we talk about the impact of invasive species on our environment and our native species. So we've got a significant issue in Australia where invasive species are a really significant driver of extinction. And I think that when people think about animal extinctions, particularly with our native species, they envision it as something that's kind of happened in the past predominantly. But the reality is we are still seeing growing impacts from invasive species on our native animals and birds right to this day. So you think of things like feral foxes, cats out in the environment doing incredible damage. There's also animals like deer that are running rampant through Victoria, doing immense damage to our environment, putting a whole lot of our native animals and plants at risk and really putting pressure on a whole lot of environmental systems. That mean that that create a threatening process that put pressure on our species and expose them to significant risk. So if we're serious about protecting our very precious, unique, incredibly rich biodiversity in this country, then tackling the invasive species threat is one of the most significant things that we can do.
It's fascinating because I lived in the bush up near the high country for a number of years, and I was really blown away by, one, the level of runaway plants that were obviously planted as, you know, municipal, medicinal or other types of plants at little homesteads and stuff, and they're just wild across the landscape. But, you know, you talk about things like deer, but I mean, even chooks, wild chooks all over the place. And people are talking about Gippsland being a pristine environment, but of course it's not, is it? And these animals have, you know, exponential disastrous effects on the landscape.
Yeah, and Victoria is you know, we used to call it the garden state, but the garden has become really overrun. The reality is Victoria is the most cleared state in Australia.
Yeah.
All our environmental systems have been impacted in some way by what the things that we have introduced to the environment, whether that be animal species, whether that be the plants that have turned into weeds that are now filling, you know, entire parts of the ecosystem and really changing the way those systems work. You can go to parts of Victoria where its entire forest gullies are just covered in blackberry.
Yeah.
Or you can go, you don't have to go far from Melbourne to up into the Dandenong and Yarra Ranges to see the impact of plants like English ivy.
Yeah.
Or wandering trad, which is everywhere up there, and the impact of those Malane. Plants is really significant. Yeah. And these are things that you can still go and buy at nurseries today. So we have this relationship with invasive plants and species that I think is sometimes all backwards in Australia. We don't value our environmental, you know, our significant and unique biodiversity as much as we should. And we keep introducing and exposing, you know, our precious environment to these threatening systems that are having a really devastating impact out there.
Now, the Invasive Species Council's going to have an evening next week where you've got people coming to, because you're raising people's awareness. It's not just you're creating a community, but you're also getting people to understand how extensive and important this issue is.
That's right. We do a whole range of events and activities. I've been touring around Victoria and holding community forums and meetings about invasive species, particularly around the deer issue in Victoria. We, we have a significant problem in Victoria in that we protect deer as a game species in order to maintain a high population so people can enjoy.
What, eating deer? Oh, hunting deer and eating venison, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and so we've now got the largest population of deer in the country. There's hundreds of thousands of these.
Oh my
animals.
God!
Yeah. And they are having a really significant impact on our natural environment. They're trashing our forests. They're polluting the waterways. They're an increasing menace on the roads. They're having a really devastating impact on landholders and farmers, but we have this kind of different attitude to deer and different legal framework around deer in Victoria to every other mainland state and territory, and that kind of puts us behind where we really ought to be in terms of trying to deal with these animals. So,
well, that actually is very interesting because of the active push by the Victorian government is actually actively preferencing game fishers and shooters.
Yeah, and so we've got a kind of cultural thing in Victoria where we have our laws around deer flow from the idea that we should be protecting the populations of deer that exist as a gaming resource. Now, this is antiquated thinking. This is a throwback to, you know, 19th century idea of you know, making our landscape more European and more Northern Hemisphere-like for the enjoyment of people who want to...
What, the landed gentry going around doing their shooting holidays?
Yeah, it's a bit of that. But the reality is that the problem we've got is we now have you know, anywhere up to, you know, hundreds of thousands, 700,000, even a million deer have been some of the estimates for Victoria.
Oh, my God.
These are huge numbers of animals that are doing an, it's really significant damage to the environment. And it's when you go to places like East Gippsland, where I was a few weeks ago, talking to people out there and kind of documenting some of the impacts, you see the really shocking state of some parts of the forest. So deer do things like they'll rub on trees, which exposes the hardwood to pathogens and fungal disease. And so, and they eventually push trees over. So you can see rainforest gullies that would ordinarily be damp and quite shady that have been opened up, that have no mid-canopy trees.
God.
So it's changing. They're almost like, the way I put it is that these animals are kind of terraforming the environment. They're changing it at a fundamental level to be something different to what it has been. And so, you know, this exposes us to all sorts of issues. It puts incredible pressure on our native species. It does incredible damage to our forests. These animals like trash our waterways. So you just have to see the wallows that they make and the damage that they do to creeks and streams and the habitat loss that means for, you know, iconic species like platypus and.
Oh my God, it's terrible! It's even worse.
They kind of act like a kind of a force multiplier for other threats, you know. So where they go, you get these, you know, weedy, invasive species that grow up after them. So that becomes changes the forest. So the forests become more bushfire prone. So really, they're a problem on a whole lot of different levels.
Oh, goodness. If people want to, we have to finish off. It's a quite a dark sort of subject, really, but it's incredibly important. Tell people about the information night so that they can perhaps go along and perhaps be part of the positive change.
Yeah, look, if people want to get in touch with me, they're very welcome to do so. My email address is just johnk@invasives.org.au. If they want to find out more about what we're doing, what we're up to, that's the best way to get in touch. Or they can just go to our website and that'll get through to me. I'm running a series of information and community nights over the next few months. I'll be in different parts of the state talking about that. And I think it's really important that people understand that there are some, you know, there are stories of hope in all this. There's really amazing work being done to protect our native species, to rewild the environment in places where we can protect habitat and give threatened species, you know, a chance to thrive. And I think, you know, we've got this bird flu situation happening right now, which is a really dark time. It's a really confronting time. But I think it also presents us with a challenge where we can respond with some kind of positivity by doing everything that we can as a community, as government, as ordinary people, to give our iconic, precious native species the very best chance of coming through this crisis and recovering on the other side. So I think... as a community, we have a choice about how we respond to these threats, and it's really important that we work collectively to come up with solutions and to, you know, encourage government, and I use the word encourage in the strongest possible sense, to really, you know, put their money where their mouth is and fund the type of stuff that we know works to give our species the very best fighting chance.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, John.
It's been a pleasure, Annie. Thank you.
best possible thing for the person that you love.
Solidarity Brekkie team listener, when the glaring differences in the sundry immigration policies were evident as they reared their ugly head. Perhaps celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Tampa, when former big supremo little Johnny Howhart and his humanitarian sidekick Peter Root the workers were forced to announce, "We would decide who comes here." Oh, how the terrenilious non-land, non-people must wish they'd had that choice 238 years ago, when the first no proper papers queue jumping illegal boat people arrived, forced to announce, and these cruel, heartless refugees fleeing the horrors of a true blue Aussie invasion of their country, as usual on the coattails of the US, of the UN, of the US of the world, who throw their dear little children overboard, but not dear enough little children to be able to live in true blue Aussie and destroy our multiculturalism. Now reduced, we know, to No Notions moron culture. And as the socialists tie themselves in knots to appease the moron culture set, seemingly setting an annual figure of around 230,000, the moron culture spokesperson David Farr rightly told us their figure is 130,000. Oh, plus 100,000 in Pacific Island and other essential slave labour, which hang on, 230,000, exactly the same. Although their apoplectic scrambles by that appalling Hoonsun and her upside of brackets temporary barnacle to explain what he really meant to say was, and then the caring business class party being outflanked out on the far right by the moron culturalists, announced they would take the middle ground between 230,000 and, wait for it, 230,000, which is therefore also, hang on again, exactly the same. So the debate rages on, the difference is glaring. Socialists 230, moron culture 230, caring business class, hayseed and sheepshit parties 230. And as under the legacy of little Johnny's compassion, True Blue Aussie continues to ignore True Blue Aussie's obligations under the refugee protocol, we signed, commemorating the 25 years then New Zealand big supremo Helen Clark, who accepted many of the young Tampa refugees and later reunited them with their families, said they had made a wonderful contribution to New Zealand life. But back here, it was worth it. Little Johnny snatched electoral victory from the jaws of defeat. Even after fleeing Afghanistan, the Tampa refugees joined the thousands of innocent collateral damage. One headline this week, No Notion Migration Policy in a Shambles. Let's think about that. Yeah, that probably sums it up pretty well, and that's their number one policy, even allowing for stretching the definition of policy. And as the socialists scramble to show they can be as cruel as the best of them on immigration policy, one headline this week will come as a totally out-of-character surprise. Big Supremo backpedals over Bowinder Capital's data center renewal energy mandate. See? Anthony met the state supremos determined, along with fossil pollution minister Chris Bowinder Capital, that the power and water-guzzling data centres all the supremos are falling over themselves to attract must generate their own renewable electricity. Bad luck about the water, but Northern Troubler Wazzy and Her Most Gracious Majesty's Land Supremo said, "Get stuffed, we're using fossils, fossils, fossils." Bad luck about Mother Earth. After which Anthony said they were different because they had public ownership of power generation. Not exactly sure how that justifies destroying the planet, but fancy that. Anthony backpedals. The destruction, the massive extraction of power, the insatiable thirst for scarce water resources on a dry continent are worth every negative thanks to investment, investment, investment and jobs, jobs, jobs. A cornucopia. Although maybe not. A spoil sport has pulled the cornucopia investment jobs claims apart. Most of the money spent building and fitting out a new data center is imported. The check is quite literally sent overseas, a mob called Yarra Capital concluded. 82% of the total cost is stuff that is imported. That means you can take all the giant data center pipeline talk with a big cup of salt. The $150 billion investment boom kicked around by investment banks and brokers, you can discount by 82%. Anyway, to paraphrase that other well-known quote, 18% out of 100 ain't bad. Cruel, cruel Yarra Capital, an economic iconoclast. And we know the caring business class, and particularly its big polluters, have long complained about the crippling burden of red and especially green tape, having to report on their climate financial impacts, for instance. Well, good news. Big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital wants to soften the blow, a consultation paper this week aimed at watering down the environmental impact disclosure requirements. Hard to believe there's room for watering them down, but anyway, also hard to know how the big-time polluters will react. Will they, for instance, say, "No, no, we need even tighter rules to save Mother Earth," or "Good idea, stuff Mother Earth"? Imagine the in-depth boardroom debates. The environment is much more important than our profits. Although, again, maybe not, because the big polluters reckon the government proposal doesn't go far enough. Under this proposal, we'll still have to report on our pollution. The only worse outcome, attacking business confidence, attacking productivity, attacking certainty, those critical criteria allowing us to benefit the country, benefit the community, being good corporate citizens, would be if we had to actually do something about our pollution. Bringing us to the aluminium smelting industry, just as Anthony and the team have forked out a minimum open-ended $2.5 billion to bail out the Tomago smelter because its owner, Rio Tinto the Planet, can't possibly afford, else it would eat into its record profits. As the Troubler was the Aluminium Profits Council explained, the electricity guzzling sector, pollution on steroids, requires, quote, flexible levers, whatever that means, for sectors with limited mitigation options. See, the poor dears can't help but pollute to their big heart's content, but all for the most altruistic of motives. Unless Pollution Minister Bowen at the Capital provides those flexible levers, they'll have to close down. And all those poor unemployed workers, their sole concern. They did mention the word transition, presumably from huge pollution to even huger pollution. Any bets on which way the government will go? One report said this is politically difficult for Bowen at the Capital, who is managing the conflicting priorities of business and environmental groups. You mean there's a clash? Another dedicated devotee of transition, Santosas the Prophets, was rhapsodic over fracking the onomatopoeic Bootaloo Basin. The Bootaloo has enough gas to supply 10 million tons of liquefied natural gas and supply the East Coast gas market for more than 50 years. More than 50 years. Now that's real dedication to transition from yourself to yourself. And the other friend of Mother Earth, Woodside with Profits, has abandoned its clean energy target, but for the most reasonable and understandable of reasons, to lift profits. In fairness, Woodside, WITS, Santos, us and all the big polluters dedicated to the transition are more than happy to do their bit for the environment as long as it doesn't cost them anything. And pollution has its advantages. South Korea has joined the scramble for shipping to save heaps of time by hugging the Arctic coast, taking advantage of the big ice melt. While at the opposite end, there are fears for wildfires, that's Americanese, we call them bushfires, as what was Antarctic ice turns green into grass. Worse, though, the impact on the little leisure activities of the filthy rich polluters themselves. They're being forced to head off to Japan for their snow holidays as true blue Aussie resorts are closing early after the worst snow falls on record. Poor dears. Not so poor. Thanks to US old big supremo Donald Trump, the poor's attempts to undermine evil China's dominance of rare metals, rare earths, true blue Aussie polluter Linus Up the Profits, which also happily pollutes in Malaysia, announced a $222.4 million record profit, up 27 times in a year. While as the socialists strike the sensible balance between the gambling industry and the gambling industry, Tab Up the Profits Corp announced an annual increase of 26.5%. So these massive increases are good for all of us, we asked. Absolutely, the more the merrier. We are doing our best for the economy. Yes, the more the merrier. Japan, here we come. And notice workers' wages increased by 3.2%, less than inflation. So you give them a big increase, maybe 26 or 27%. Good God, no. Those excessive wage increases are killing the economy, destroying this country. What this country needs is wage restraint, not the out-of-control greed of selfish workers. A view confirmed by Graham Watson, former Fair Work True Blue Aussie, no longer Work Choices, just looks like a commissioner, self-styled caring business class relations expert who called for a return to the halcyon days of former world's greatest worst ex-treasurer Paul at his good union sidekick Little Billy killed them. The socialist caring business class relations laws were destroying us all, Graham explained. We must return to Paul and Little Billy, which allowed the aforementioned Little Johnny and Peter Root the workers to introduce work choices, enabling evil unions one-on-one negotiation between caring employers and, getting rid of evil unions and one-on-one negotiation between caring employers and lazy avaricious workers. Win-win. Which leaves us to ponder why evil unions were so opposed to such a win-win scenario. Greed and avarice are, we suppose, and when thieves fall out, even Macquarie Bank has dumped poor KPMG as its auditor. KPMG, one of the big four financial behemoths, and worse, a professor of accounting says nothing, sit down, listener, nothing will fix KPMG's greed, arrogance, and stupidity. Greed, arrogance and stupidity, one of the great global citizens. Finally, the progressive Northern True Blue Aussie government, which knows what's good for Terra Nullius non-land non-people much more than the Terra Nullius non-land non-people themselves, wants to make Northern True Blue Aussie and Darwin a huge being offensive and train-killing centre, with five priorities including establishing the Northern Territory as the home of defence industry testing and evaluation. Wonder what the Terra Nullius non-land non-people think of that. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. You're on fire, man. And you're back with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got David Mould on the line. G'day, David. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Annie. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, and you're from the Victorian Wildlife Alliance. You sent out a release saying that it's important that the public actually your volunteers step in where the government is failing when it comes to bird flu.
That's right. Bird flu is an unfolding crisis at the moment for our wildlife. We've known it was coming for a long time, like over a year, and we've been telling the government in all that time it was coming, we need to prepare. They haven't done so, and I fear that the public is woefully underinformed on this. We've now had the first case detected in Werribee, so bird flu has now hit Melbourne. It's not just in the coastal towns in Western Victoria. So people really need to be aware and alert on this one, and we really need to put more pressure on the government to step up and actually do something about bird flu, because at the moment it's falling all back on volunteer shoulders. We just don't have the resources and the capacity to do the job that needs to be done. And communities up and down the coast are furious that they've been left abandoned, effectively, as birds keep dying on their shores. It's very distressing for them.
Oh, I bet you it is. Can you tell us a little bit about what you expect from the government? What can that larger resources mean? What would that mean?
Well, these are some of the things that they should have been doing for ages, but it's not too late for them to finally start. And the very first thing they could be doing is actually sending out some trained teams to be patrolling areas where we know bird flu is happening, removing the dead birds because they are a prime vector of disease. What people don't seem to realise is that that disease, bird flu, is lasting in the body for 5, 6, 7 months after the bird has died. So many opportunities for scavengers or maybe someone walking their dog or children playing in the area to come into contact with that virus. So the very first thing the government needs is dedicated teams that are present where we know there are outbreaks, constantly removing the dead bodies and providing relief to those who are suffering. There are dying birds out there, incredibly upsetting to see. There's not much that can be done for them except humane euthanasia. Leaving them to die horribly is just the cruelest thing I can think of. That's the very first thing the government could be doing. They could be resourcing rescuers. They could be providing the PPE equipment that we need. They could be providing quarantine facilities. They could be doing literally anything, but currently we're seeing nothing.
David, it's Matthew here. One of the things I don't think a lot of people are aware of, I saw a news report last Saturday and I was quite shocked. The report was that it's actually, they found that it's a seal population has been contracted with bird flu. And if I remember the report correctly, it's actually the first time that it's actually crossed to a mammal species.
Well, it's crossed to mammal species a few times around the world in the years past, so we knew that that was going to happen too. Last year, we lost over 13,000 elephant seal pups on Heard Island. This is the first time we've had it in a mammal on mainland Australia. And it's happened twice now with seals. We think it's happened two times with foxes now as well, which is really concerning because they will travel inland. And a recent report also determined that it has been found in a dolphin. So
oh my goodness.
This is a disaster. Yes.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, right. Okay. So, in fact, you're the Victorian Wildlife Alliance is actually activated, and you've called people to Portland Yacht Club for Sunday, Monday to actually do humane euthanasia of birds that are ailing in obvious large amounts down across the southwest.
Well, I mean, the ridiculous thing is the Wildlife Alliance was brought together as a group of advocacy groups for wildlife, different wildlife animals that were being let down by the government. So our role was always about information, education and advocacy to the government. When we saw that the government was absent, we started making some noise about it. And at that point, wildlife rescuers just stepped up. They said, well, that's it. I've had enough of waiting. I'm going. So we've been providing some support for them in terms of logistics and coordination. But these are individuals who stepped up because they kept hearing the government say, oh, well, there's not much we can do. And
oh
in 24
goodness.
Hours in Portland, those rescuers proved that they can do more than the government could do in a year.
David, it's Matthew again. What about the federal government's response or lack of response?
Well, the federal government has left a lot of it to the states to deliver the on-the-ground resourcing and action, which Victoria has been absent for. But they've poured some money in. I know BirdLife Australia has been asking for an investment of $200 million in order to promote the recovery of species after the bird flu has sort of ravaged everything, so we can give them the best chance of surviving and returning their numbers. And I know the federal government put in 10% of that, which seems completely inadequate.
Well, considering that they can put money into war machines, it seems pretty extraordinary to us.
Yeah, when you measure it against the submarine, nuclear submarine, it seems like they've only got... This is beer money for the government. They've found some coins behind the couch and they threw it at wildlife. It's contemptuous, and it seems that the governments have really abandoned wildlife.
Would it be right to describe it as a crisis, David?
Absolutely. Yes, this is a crisis, and it's only going to get worse. We've always known this because we saw it unfold in the rest of the world, and Australia got lucky that we avoided it last year. We knew it was going to come to us, though. In other parts of the world, there have been absolute disasters coming through, even mainland, hitting mammals, hitting family pets. I mean, one thing your listeners should be aware of, cats should be kept inside from now on because cats are very vulnerable to this disease. And we just can't assume that it's not here or things are fine. We have to take all the precautions we can now, and we have to do it because the government won't.
David, how can people get involved in a positive way?
The first thing we should be aware of is people without training and people without the proper protective equipment should be very careful when they see a bird that they think is sick and might have bird flu. The disease can jump to humans. It doesn't very often. It's pretty rare, but it can. So we want people to be mindful of that. And if they do see a bird, to let someone know. There is a hotline for the government to be informed, but that seems pretty useless. So make sure you inform a wildlife rescuer who can maybe do something about it. If you're on one of those coastal towns where there's large mass mortality events happening, one of the best things to do is to let us know so we can arrange some sort of a response in the absence of government action, and then we can get down there. If you want to be involved, we need spotters, we need people finding where they are and letting us know, and keeping other people back, because this is such a scary thing. In Portland, I saw people picnicking and playing around where dead bodies were lying, and this is a dangerous time for that. We've even seen a whole lot of dead bodies being left around vulnerable animals like Sammy the seal in Portland, who's an iconic seal, a lot like Neil the seal in Tasmania, but nowhere near so destructive. And he's a family favourite in the area, but there's photos of him lying down on the wharf there with dead birds right next to his head. And this is, no one's doing anything about it except for volunteers, which is just insane to me.
So you've got an action scheduled for Sunday and Monday, so people meeting at Portland Yacht Club at 1:30 p.m. on Sunday.
That was last Sunday. We're hoping to have some rescuers down there monitoring again this weekend. But like I say, there's just not enough rescuers. There never has been enough rescuers to do this job. We've always had to rely on a government who seems to have vacated the field entirely. So we'll try and get volunteers down to each of those coastal towns that are reporting mass events, everywhere from Nelson through to Port Ferry, Apollo Bay, Warrnambool, and now a few in Geelong are coming up. And we're just stretched too thin. So if volunteers, if community members can let us know where things are happening, we can try and focus the resources in the right places. But again, as I say, this wasn't really what we were ever set up for. We're stepping into a void that has been left by the government, and they're quite happy to still leave the instruction of just leave the dead bodies where they are. But as I say, if that virus can stay in the body for months and months and months, all we're doing is creating vector for disease by doing that. So volunteers are the only people trying to flatten this curve.
So you have a website presence?
We have a social media presence. We can be found on Facebook particularly. That would be the best way to find us.
Okay, the Victorian Wildlife Alliance. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, David.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you, David.
Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
It really is, Annie. That's a dereliction of government's responsibility.
We're going to go to our last report today because there's been a large amount of anniversaries. One of the anniversaries is the 45th anniversary of the deaths of the Irish Republican hunger strikers, including Bobby Sands, Francis Hughes, Joe McDonald, Thomas McElwee, Michael Devane, Raymond McCreesh, Patsy O'Hare. at Longkesh Prison in Ireland in 1981. I got to speak to a person who is in particularly interested in the welfare of Ireland and Northern Ireland in particular, Adair Ardo. He's part of, he set up a group called the Irish Anti-Colonial Warriors, but I'll let him introduce himself.
I'd just like to introduce myself. My name is Dare, or Derry, which is my Irish name. I have established a group called Irish Anti-Colonial Warriors to keep abreast of what's happening over in Ireland at the moment.
I'm kind of interested in the fact that it's the 45th anniversary of the hunger strikers, like Bobby Sands, the Irish people who put their lives on the line. Do you want to talk about those events and how important they were?
Yes, this marks the 45th anniversary of the hunger strike, where Bobby Sands, Joe McDonnell, Francis Hughes, Thomas McAwee, Michael Devine, Raymond McCresh, and Patsy O'Hara were in Longkesh Prison and started a hunger strike to protest the British occupation of Northern Ireland. They gave their lives and passed away. And it was a very sad time in Ireland for the Republicans when that happened, but it was, an important stand against British imperialism in Northern Ireland and the occupation. What, unfortunately, we're facing today is the fact that their sacrifice appears to have really not brought out results with the current political elite in Ireland. There was the Sunningdale negotiations in 1973, which produced the same outcomes as in the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. The only difference between that and the 1998 agreement was there was a troop withdrawal from the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. But what we've got instead in Northern Ireland is a PSNI police force, which is controlled by MI5 and British laws in Northern Ireland, and they disproportionately focus on, staunch Republican people in Northern Ireland who want Britain to be totally out of Northern Ireland.
And reunification of the two parts of Ireland.
Yes, the reunification, and importantly, under the, the legacy of what James Connolly wanted for Ireland is one of the important things, because that means total freedom for Ireland, away from not just the colonial control of Britain, the military, or the police paramilitary control, or the political control, but also the corporate type control Britain has over Ireland. Also,
you point out that in actual fact the process towards reunification won't happen unless the English consider, their representative considers that it's appropriate. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that within the Good Friday Agreement, which Sinn Féin agreed with, and the current Fianna Fáil government, which is in power in Ireland, which they agreed upon within the Good Friday Agreement, is that the Secretary of State of Britain has the final say, or the Secretary of State of Britain for Northern Ireland has the final say on whether there be a border poll for a reunification and a free island.
So we're talking about Northern Ireland here, aren't we?
Yes, correct. Yeah. Correct. And please remember that also the so-called free state in Ireland is really has a lot of control from Britain. The free state is a member of the EU, and the British have a lot of control over the EU with military type exchange control and influence over the EU much more than the Free State of that the Free State of Ireland.
Even though it's not actually a member of the EU?
Yeah, no, they've got another agreement where they have strong control within the EU, yes. And that's militarily and also, you know, financially. It's a separate type of agreement than the EU agreement that Britain has. In regards to the Secretary of State of signing off on Northern Ireland's freedom, Michelle O'Neill of the current Sinn Féin party, which are not in power, but the current Sinn Féin party, put up a unity bill, which got knocked down. And Michelle O'Neill just met the Prime Minister of Britain. And the Prime Minister of Britain said, we have no interest in having a border poll at all. So that type of false hope has been put out to the Irish people for a long time by Sinn Féin, which is unfortunate.
Let's bring it to the present day. With the recent race riots and the DUP, what the Democratic Unionist Party's connection to those race riots?
Going into the issue of what happened in Northern Ireland, say about a year ago, 2 years ago, there was a guy named Mark Sinclair, who was an ex-RUC, I think he was in the RUC, sort of the Ulster military group, loyalist group, which was allied to Britain. He started cultivating anti-immigration racism within Ireland, saying that we want to unite with the Irish people on this cause. Tommy Robinson, the a racist scumbag from Britain, also was sort of involved in cultivating that in Ireland. But it was mainly cultivated with the loyalist, the British following loyalist people of Northern Ireland, not the general Irish people. The DUP are akin to One Nation in Northern Ireland. Like the One Nation here, they're monarchists. The DUP are monarchists to the hilt. And they are dog whistling this anti-immigration racism. And just a day or a few days before the riots, the DUP Member of Parliament, Clara Lockhart, was photographed with masked youths. I think it was they were there to intimidate a pro-Palestine rally. And those masked youths have not been identified, but we are quite sure they were youths involved in the racist riots, where they went around to people from immigrant backgrounds and in one case they burnt a person's home and smashed windows and were rioting through the streets. And they were carrying British flags or British loyalist flags with them while they were doing that.
Do they consider themselves to be English?
Yeah, yes. Basically, they're people of Irish descent. Some may come back to what we call planters or Scottish people that the British Empire planted in Northern Ireland. Yes, they consider themselves as basically, they would consider Northern Ireland as British, and they are very much loyal to the royal family and to the British Empire.
And so, and those suburbs that they attacked, they are the same suburbs that were attacked during the Troubles, that were the homes of Catholic Irish people, right?
Yes, yes, and Catholic and Republican Irish people, yes. And there were some good Republicans that have gone out to support those immigrant communities during the riots. And there are groups within Northern Ireland of what I consider true Republicans who've spoken out against these racist riots. And another sad fact too I have to bring up was the fact that who brought the DUP into Parliament, and that was through the Paisley Agreement, which Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin, along with Tony Blair and the Democratic Labour Party in Northern Ireland, agreed upon, was called the Paisley Agreement, which Sinn Féin agreed to have a power-sharing arrangement and bring the DUP into the Stormont Parliament in Northern Ireland. So this is akin to, I suppose, anti-fascist people inviting One Nation into a power-sharing arrangement in a parliament. And that Stormont Parliament is controlled by Britain as well. So, yeah, so Ireland does not have sovereignty and the struggle continues.
Thank you for giving us an understanding of what's going on. And I suppose also thank you for reminding us about the ultimate sacrifice of those very, very brave people who died in 1981, standing up for a free Ireland.
Yeah, yes, and thank you for having me on. And look, I'd just like to say to everybody, the struggle does continue against imperialism in Ireland. And everybody can have a look at our Facebook called Irish Anti-Colonial Warriors. And we'd appreciate support in highlighting more of what's happening over there.
Okay, thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you for your time. Take care.
Yeah. And that's the end of the program, Matt. What, we've had a full board today.
It's been a really interesting show.
Yeah. If you do say so yourself.
Yeah. We celebrating quite a number of significant anniversaries. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We're going to go out with a song by Red Camellia. Now, Red Camellia is a local band. The song is Overburning. They've got a single launch tonight at the Last Chance Bar, 238 Victoria Street, North Melbourne. If you want to kick up your heels, go and help them celebrate their launch.
Just near the Victoria Market.
Yeah, just... very nice thing to do. Okay, here we go. Overburning.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.